Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed. It's Thursday, which of course means it's Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. Our author, Robert George, is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University and a leading scholar in law, ethics, and political philosophy. The book is Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. And I'd like to just start off, what's a driving force behind this particular book for you?
Well, the driving force, Nick, is my belief that young people have come to identify truth with feeling, with emotion, rather than with rationality. And this has all sorts of baleful effects for our society. First of all, if we go searching for truth in our viscera, in our emotions, we're not going to find it. And secondly, it has led to a kind of authoritarianism, a desire to shut down people's freedom of speech when people disagree with them, a desire to cancel people, ruin their careers, even ruin their lives when they disagree. So I want to do what I try to do with my own children and with my students here at Princeton, and that is try to form them to be determined truth seekers and courageous truth speakers, to get the focus off of our feelings and of our emotions and how we feel, and to get back to the idea that we should try to think our way, freely think our way to our conclusions.
Well, I've got to ask, you reference your students at Princeton, and there's a stereotype about the vast majority of universities across this country and how they really seem to cater towards that very approach that so many young people seem to now have leading them, and that is emotion. I mean, are you a fish out of water there? What is that environment like? And has the university culture contributed to this age of feeling?
I very much regret to say, Nick, that the university culture has contributed. Universities have earned the unfortunate position they now find themselves in so many cases. And they've earned it by failing in their fundamental mission. And that fundamental mission is to try to get at the truth of things. That's why faculty are paid to do their research, write their books and articles, trying to get at the truth of things. In our teaching, we're meant to help our young people to think more deeply and more clearly, and to think for themselves, to really be determined truth seekers and courageous truth speakers. And universities so often have allowed classes to degenerate into indoctrination sessions. Instead of learning history or philosophy or sociology, sometimes I think it's become a kind of catechism class for progressive or woke dogmas. One of the fundamental problems is simply the lack of viewpoint diversity on the faculties of most universities. If I do feel a little bit like a fish out of water, it might have something to do with the fact that I dissent from a lot of political and moral opinions and religious ideas that the vast majority of my colleagues here at Princeton and more broadly in the academic world hold. If we're to do our jobs rightly, if we're to be first-class scholars and first-class teachers, then we're going to need to interact more with people who look at the world differently than we do, have different perspectives, raise different issues, challenge us, criticize us, get us thinking, get us re-examining our opinions.
I noticed some time ago, and I imagine this is all part of it, I would hear people start to talk about, well, my truth. And to me, that just seemed like such a contradiction, because truth is a constant. It's not something that, in my opinion anyhow, is alterable based off of one's wants and desires. It's like saying my gravity. I mean, gravity is gravity. Truth is truth. Is this part of this cultural sort of evolution, and is it deliberate, or is it something that naturally evolved, you think, with this mindset?
It's a very big problem, Nick. So a lot of young people today come to college, and then when they get to college, they're reinforced in the idea that truth is merely subjective. Your truth depends on how you feel. My truth depends on how I feel. But of course, the truth isn't subjective or relative in that way at all. Washington either did or didn't cross the Delaware. you know, the sun either rises in the east or it doesn't rise in the east. It sets in the west or it doesn't set in the west. No, there's not your truth and my truth. There's the truth. And the truth might be hard to understand. It might be hard to get at. We might have reasonable disagreements about what the truth is. But we have to agree that there's a truth there to be sought. And then let's do our best, marshaling the best evidence on the competing sides, the best arguments on all sides of the question, to see if we can get to the truth. The trouble, Nick, when a student comes to believe that he has his truth and the other guy may have his truth and I might have my truth, but there's no such thing as the truth, that student will regard himself as immunized against critique or challenge or criticism. If you have your truth, there's nothing I can say. If your truth is just how you feel, there's nothing I can say about how you feel. You have now cut yourself off from your only chance of ever learning anything, and that is by being challenged, by having your views examined, by needing to defend your views with rational arguments, simply than saying, well, this is how I feel, and there's the end of the discussion.
We're talking with our author of the week, Robert George, the book Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. I grew up in an era where it seemed as if it was around the beginning of the participation ribbon era. And I remember the conventional wisdom was, well, just wait until those young people get into the real world. They'll have a real rude awakening. And I think a lot of us felt as if that would be the outcome. However, it seems to me as if what has occurred is that many of these individuals have now gotten into positions of influence and power to where they are crafting the, quote, real world. And so instead of that correcting itself, it seems to be spreading like a cancer because we have these individuals with this sort of participation trophy, which I think is in line with you're always right. You're always special. You're always a winner. There is a disconnect from that truth and that reality. And we've gone from those being just kids in school, and we do still, I think, reference, well, young people and students, but I fear even maybe on the Supreme Court we have one or two of these people, and certainly in academia. Is that a fair assessment?
Brother Nick, I have to tell you, you're a man after my own heart. I think you are right on the mark there. Bad ideas that began in universities. A lot of people thought, well, we'll be able to get over this because students are going to go out into the real world and they'll face the challenges of the real world, and the real world can be very unforgiving, and they'll wake them up and they'll abandon these bad ideas. But of course, as you say, I'm just repeating what you said now, that isn't what happened. What actually happened is these bad ideas were exported by students who'd been through universities from the universities into the workplace, into the corporate world, into the law firm world, indeed, even into the world of medicine, which one would have thought would be pretty much immune from ideological corruption. But we've found ideological corruption really across the spectrum of disciplines and fields out there in the real world now. Yeah. It began in the universities, but it didn't stay in the universities. And there's a lesson in that. What begins in the intellectual culture doesn't stay in the intellectual culture. It spreads from there.
Why do you think, let me lay this out. It seems to me as if people who have the truth on their side, who are those that seek the actual truth, take the intellectual approach, oftentimes are much less comfortable expressing that to someone who has an opposing viewpoint. And the people who really aren't based in truth, but instead are based on emotion, have no trouble whatsoever. There's like not this comfort zone that bothers them. They will scream and yell at people. They will get in anyone's face. And it just seems upside down. It seems as if they should be the insecure because they don't have facts on their side, but the people who have the facts on their side should be those that are less timid. But it just oftentimes seems as if it doesn't play out that way.
Well, if we are to be determined truth seekers, as we all should be, that does mean we're going to have to be cognizant of our own fallibility. We will never be good truth seekers if we think we're infallible, if we think we already know it all, if we think we have nothing to learn from people who disagree with us. to be a genuine truth seeker means you have to have a kind of intellectual humility. That's a real virtue. And if you have that, then you're not going to be comfortable just shoving your views down other people's throats or getting in people's faces or shouting at them. You recognize I could be wrong about this, and so I want to lay my argument out, but I also want to listen to the other guy's argument. And maybe that has something to do with the situation that you just described. Or the alternative and less charitable interpretation would be it's simply cowardice, that people who are decent people, who don't want to shout in other people's faces, you know, people who are, you know, serious about getting at the truth of things, are just too afraid of the bullies to stand up to them. And if it's that, then it's a virtue problem. And we're going to have to overcome that fear of speaking the truth as best we understand the truth, knowing we can be wrong, but doing our best to speak the truth courageously, even when other people aren't going to like it.
Our author of the week is Robert George, the book Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. It, to me, seems that in those formative years, you hear that it's so easy for young people to learn a new language or learn multiple languages, but after your brain gets past a certain point, it becomes much, much more difficult. And I think that we do a great disservice to young people when we coddle this sort of, this perspective of my own truth and feeling, to where when they become adults, it's not as easy to overcome. And so how is it that you recommend people who are truth seekers and have conversations with people who were not raised that way, whose brains have been wired in the way of emotion? Is it one possible to even have meaningful conversations? Because it's two completely different languages. And if it is possible, what is that approach?
Well, it does, Nick, take two to tango. To have a serious conversation, you need two serious conversation partners. If one person is serious about having a conversation and the other guy just wants to give you a lecture, you're not going to be able to have a conversation. So I'm sorry about that. I wish it were otherwise. But sometimes it is possible to make a little progress, even with someone who seems intransigent and dogmatic and ideological and unwilling to listen. And that is just by asking questions. Mm. Why do you believe that? What's your basis for that belief? What's the evidence you have? Have you considered this counterargument? What would you say to somebody who raised this point or that point against the view that you're now defending? How do you account for the fact that there are very intelligent people who take a different view than yours? Do you just think they're ignoramuses? Do you just think they're bigots? Do you just think they're idiots? I think that sometimes will help people to wake up to the fact that they too might be wrong. They too are fallible. And all of us, Nick, are fallible not only about the minor, trivial, superficial things of life or the things we don't care that much about. We'd all acknowledge our fallibility on those points. But we're also fallible, and we have to admit it to ourselves, on the big, important questions, the things we really care about, the questions of human nature, the human good, human dignity, human rights, human destiny. And that intellectual humility that comes with a recognition of our fallibility should help us in our conversations with other people. It should help us to have genuinely civil dialogue, even with people who deeply disagree with us on questions that really matter to us.
One final, I guess it's a question of sorts. I've had this thought, and perhaps it's just hope, but whether or not you think there is any validity in this. And I've noticed over the last couple of years or so, there's been a great popularity with what I would call thinkers, going to universities, the Charlie Kirks, the Ben Shapiros, and welcoming questions from people on the left and countering, oftentimes, as you said, their assertions with questions. And I have found that even in high school, that people are following these videos. Young people seem to find them very, very engaging. And my hope is that it's because, as oftentimes things cycle, this is something new, the idea of thinking about things and having to explain yourself. And so because it's new and shiny to younger people, high school, college age, they find themselves gravitating towards it. Because I don't know if you've seen these videos, but there'll be hundreds of kids standing around watching this stuff as if they're watching some sort of sport and they're engaged in it. And my hope is that just even from an observational standpoint, maybe there is hope that these younger generations are sort of cycling themselves out of what has become the norm because it's the norm, and instead are finding themselves engaged and interested in the intellectual approach to things. Is that just wishful thinking, or do you think there may be something to that?
No, it's not wishful thinking. I'm now going to say something you're probably not going to hear a lot of professors say. I commend Charlie Kirk and Ben Shapiro and others who go to university campuses knowing that the dominant opinion is going to be overwhelmingly against them, but who go, who invite the students into public civil dialogues, who invite the students, especially the students who disagree with them, to challenge them, to raise questions, to criticize their points of view, and get a genuine conversation going. That should be what life is like every day. That should be the norm in universities. And it's kind of a shame that it seems to be the case that somebody has to come in from the outside to get that kind of action going at a university. So I think that's great when people do that. Now, I just wish people on the left side of the political spectrum would learn from people like Charlie Kirk and Ben Shapiro that this is a good thing to do and do it themselves. They should offer themselves in conservative forums and say, let me come in and have a civil dialogue with you, and let me give you an opportunity to challenge me and question me on any point that you want to ask. I think Charlie Kirk and Ben Shapiro are really setting a good example for everybody here.
Back to the days of F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal.
that's exactly right. William F. Buckley was the master of this.
Oh boy, was he ever. Our author of the week, again, Robert George, thank you so much for being with us. Author of the week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, where you can pick up Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Movement. For Springfield's Talk 104.1, I'm Nick Reed.